Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Well, good evening, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to the Stop Child Abuse Now talk radio show sponsored by NASCA, which stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Penelope Bennis, and I am from Sarasota, Florida, and Bellevue, Washington. I'm also an adult survivor of child abuse. This is scan number 3046. It is Monday, November 7th, 2022. Type of show we have tonight is special guest night, and we have a return special guest. She's a NASCA family member and just an absolutely incredible human being, a wonderful, wonderful author on many books that cover a lot of different topics. Tonight specifically, we'll be focusing on her newest book and on betrayal, none other than the famous to me, Holly Kenly from Rancho Mirage, California. Before I tell you a little bit more about Holly, I wanted to tell you a little bit more about NASCA and NASCA's mission, because as you know, NASCA is all about a child abuse trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. We have a single purpose at NASCA, and it's to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. The first goal, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. And the second, offering hope and healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested and the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. We invite you to join the show tonight as a panel member, and you don't have to have any prior experience to become a panel member on the NASCA show, just a willingness and curiosity to get involved. My Kim Lakin from Colorado, who's on the line, will greet you on our back line if you do choose to call in. To participate, the number to call in is area code 646-595-2118. Again, that number is area code 646-595-2118, and Kim will greet you on our back line and then bring you into the show. As a panel member, you'll have an opportunity to ask our special guest, Holly Kenly, a question or comment regarding her work. But this is her show. She is our special guest this evening. And I want to tell you a little bit more about Holly Kenly. As I mentioned, she's from Rancho Mirage, California. She is a child abuse survivor. She's a therapist. She's an author and an activist. She recently was featured on a TED Talk on betrayal, the loss of self. Holly holds a master's degree in psychology with an emphasis in marriage, family, and child. She currently works college as an author, speaker, and workshop presenter. Through her gentle but powerful, informative, and restorative approach, Holly engages clinical and lay audiences, empowering them with strategies to embrace well and whole ways of being. And to quote Holly, "Within my private practice, or wherever I'm able to reach folks, she says, it is my passion and purpose to support individuals on their journeys in living more well and whole lives. Holly is the author of numerous books. As an aside, I've read several of her books. I particularly benefited from Daughters Betrayed by Their Mothers. So I personally would highly recommend, if you are interested in learning more about the subject of betrayal, that you look into Holly's work. Her 11th book was published in January. It is entitled Shifting Bravely, A Path to Growth, Healing, and Transformation. Her recent TED Talk is Betrayal, The Loss No One is Talking About. This actually was on TED in November. She's told her abuse story on our show in the past, and she will be focusing tonight on betrayal and how that shows up for sexual abuse survivors. So without further ado, I'm not going to read any more of Holly's bio because I want to save some for her, but I'm just so so privileged and honored to be here on the show with you tonight, Holly, and I'm going to just open up the mic and turn it over to you and just thank you for being on with us tonight.
Oh, Penelope, it is such a privilege to be on your show on NASCA, and I know last time it was such a meaningful and purposeful experience for myself, and I do believe so for the listeners as well. So I thank you so much for having me back, and thank you for that introduction. And I do look forward this evening to sharing some healing insights after I share my story. And there's been a lot of new kind of thinking that's been going on around some healing insights and strategies within my work. And so I look forward to touching upon those this evening. So with that, should I go ahead and get started with my story?
Yes, if you wouldn't mind starting there, just to give some of our listeners some of your background to help paint that picture. I think sometimes context is, so that would be wonderful. And again, whatever you feel comfortable with sharing is you're totally in control. So
okay.
It's really up to you.
Not a lot of things we have control of, but I have a little bit tonight. Okay, I'd like to give a little bit of my backstory first, kind of do this in about, two parts. So a little bit of what I call my family of origin backstory, and then kind of go into some specific traumas and betrayals that occurred in my life. So to set this up is that I was born in the early 50s, and so I want to just kind of give that context of the time period. And I was born into what I refer to as an alcoholic family system. In other words, is that both of my parents were alcoholics, and as were other members of our family. It was a very critical, authoritarian system, high expectations, and a lot of sarcasm. And as I was kind of putting together my notes for the show tonight, I thought, you know what, I haven't used that word very much in all of my writings and talking about my background. But it's an important word because sarcasm is so demeaning for a child. It's very deflating and demeaning, and it's very shaming. So I wanted to put that out there, and I'll give a couple examples of what I mean by that as I go through this. So my dad was a musician and a professional musician and also a teacher, and my mother was a registered nurse. She did that a little later on when I was in my adolescent years. She went back to school to finish her education, finish her nursing degree that she had started early on and not completed. I was the second oldest of four daughters, and so my older sister and I or there's a quite a span between our next youngest sister and then the youngest sister. So we were like the parents in the family, what we call the parentified child, myself along with my older sister. And at a very young age, age 5, 6, 7, had a lot of responsibility. And that's where that word parentified child comes in. Our household was in the about the first 5 to 6 years before my youngest sister was born. I remember that being, as far back as I can remember, which is about age 4 or 5, that it was okay. It was, our needs were met. I felt maternal love. There was a sense of stress and anxiety in the home, but not like what happened when my youngest sister was born. And so she's 6 years younger than I was, I was about 6 when things really shifted in our home. My youngest sister was a difficult baby. I look back on it now, she was probably on the spectrum somewhere, but then back then that wasn't diagnosed or talked about. But our home was tense. It was like walking on eggshells. There was anger and blow-ups, especially, you know, the cocktail hour started around 5 o'clock. My parents were functional alcoholics. You know, they went and did their jobs. They did we're supposed to do, but then that cocktail hour started around 5 and things were different. And it was really scary. Blow-ups, like I said, anger. And my mother's focus shifted primarily to my youngest sister. She was just, her entire focus was on her and a lot of health issues that accompanied that. My father was working a lot, but I remember so clearly that when he came home, I was afraid of him, and he didn't hit us. It was verbal criticism, condemnation, shaming, that kind of thing. But I was just remember feeling afraid. If I was walking down, we had a long hall in our house, and if he was coming down one way and I was walking the other way, I would like try to duck into another room. So I just remember that so vividly. We didn't speak at the dinner table. We were, you know, to be seen but not heard. And so it was just, you know, because you never knew when something was going to set, especially my father, off. Mm-hmm. Moving forward a little bit, I want to just talk about discipline and two memories that stand out at an early age, and they relate to my mom. So when my older sister and I, when she perceived us as being disrespectful or not obeying her, she would take us into the bathroom, and she gave us our choice of having either our mouths washed out with soap or peppered. And I did the pepper once, and that was so horrific that from that point on, I chose the soap. Now, as you alluded to, Penelope, I mean, I'm a marriage and family therapist. I work in the areas of abuse and trauma. I've done this for over 25 years. And one of the things that I'm very, very mindful of doing is never qualifying or quantifying any kind of abuse. I just want to mention that because sometimes when we think of abuse, we say, well, it's, you know, it's physical and you're beaten to a pulp and you're, you know, this and that. But it doesn't matter what the abuse or the trauma has been, is that if it impacted the child, then it's important. And this greatly impacted me. I already didn't speak up. As I said, I was afraid to speak up, especially after the drinking hour started. But to have your mouth peppered or washed out. When I write about it, I say it was like a scouring of my soul. And I was already kind of a shy and quiet child, very compliant. So it was horrific, and that went on for a number of years. I'll mention one more thing, and then I'll pause for a second or for a minute to see if there's any comments or questions. The second thing that happened regarding my mother is that I believe, about age 8. I can't remember exactly, but every summer, I was from Northern California, and every summer, because my father was a teacher, my family spent our summers, 3 months, 2 to 3 months in the summer with my grandparents who lived in Ely, Nevada. And actually, this was a wonderful reprieve for myself and my siblings, because we loved our grandparents. There were, you know, life was just easier and different there. My parents were on what I call better behavior around my grandparents. And so every summer, my grandparents, we would go to the horse races that were in Ely, Nevada. And so one summer we were there, like I said, I think I was around 8, and they had their little private box area that we were seating in. And we were required to sit there during all of these horse races, and we did. And for some reason, and I don't know why to this day, and it doesn't even matter anymore, but I decided I didn't want to stay at the horse races. And so I turned around, I was sitting in front of my parents, and I told my mom that I wanted to go home, back to my grandparents' house, which was a good probably 10 miles or so from the horse racing tracks. And my mother said no, and I kept saying, I want to go home. You know, I don't want to stay here. And she said, well, if you're going to go home, then you're going to have to, or back to my grandparents, you're going to have to walk. So I did. I got up, I left, and from where the cars were parked to where the highway was probably a good at least a half a mile or so. Anyway, I leave, I'm walking out towards the highway, and I hear my name being yelled and called, and I turn around, and of course, there's my mother running towards me, and she catches up with me, and she had a purse in her hand and keys, and when she caught up with me, she grabbed me, and all the way back to the car, she beat me horribly. Just every step I took, it was just a thrashing, a beating. And when I write about this, Penelope, I say it was, I could feel her anger on my back and my legs and my bottom. I had a little dress on, and I was just bleeding and bruised, and got to the car, and she put me in the car, and I think I had to wait there until everybody else came out and we went home. That incident was never spoken of. It was never mentioned. It was, I remember the next day, my parents and my grandparents all left and my siblings to go somewhere else, and I stayed home because I was so badly beaten and bruised and cut up. So anyway, I want to just pause there for a minute, and if there's any comments or questions, I'm happy to take any, or I can go on.
No, thank you, Holly. I think it's a good time right now to take a pause, and we have my co-host, Kim Lakin. As I mentioned, we also have another panelist. That's the family member named Lori from New York. But I first want to just say, yeah, thank you for sharing what you shared. And I know it's not easy to share those memories. And in the last story you told about, you know, wanting to leave the horse races and Ely, Nevada, and I think, I don't know if you remember, but I certainly do, because my husband's father's from Ely, Nevada, and not a lot of people know where Ely is. But I have this.
Yes, I remember that now.
being leaving the horses in Ely, Nevada, but, you know, two things that, you know, that resonated with me. And first of all, it's just for me describing the beating of your mother and just the whole story. But as you described, you know, when your mother caught up with you on the road, I want to say every single cell in my body just responded, and I just felt this absolute anguish for you. And obviously I can relate to something like that. And I think I just want to make that comment. But the question I had was, you know, something struck me when you said you wanted to leave the horse races. You kept asking to leave, and I'm thinking, you know, based upon the history that you disclosed to us, what it was like to grow up in your home, was there something about being in that, in the horse races, in that different environment, in that venue, that you did not feel safe and you wanted to get out of there? I mean, something, you were very adamant. I'm just curious if you remember why you wanted to leave.
You know, that is such a great question. And as I'm thinking about that, there was a lot of, of age people, but probably underage as well, a lot of drinking, a lot of noise, a lot of what I call chaos. And and so that part as a child was always hard for me, crowds, and still is today. I don't really like big crowds and things. So I think that probably had something to do with it, is, you know, those components right there, just not feeling safe, and not, there was nowhere for me to go to feel safe. That's such a great question.
Well, and no, thank you for answering that question, because if I was, you know, envisioning you being in that race, the horse race track, and being inside and wanting to get out, I kept thinking, for a child that probably already, you know, as children we had a heightened sense of this intuitive, you know, intuition and knowing when we didn't feel comfortable somewhere. So that's, to me, that's already a trauma to a child, is I don't feel safe here, I want to get out, and you were given permission to leave by your mother, and then what? And then you describe what ensued when your mother caught up with you. And so to me, it's like you were already hurting, and you're trying to escape, and then there was another layer of that trauma. And anyway, I just thank you for sharing that, and I just want to give you a hug, and there's something about it that I can very much relate to, that and the pain of that, and I'm sorry that, you know, you had to go through that, and I know, you know, I'm sorry to never take away that experience or the pain, but you're just not alone in that. And I know that you know that. As, you know, survivors or, you know, fellow survivors, there's on some level we can relate.
Absolutely. And thank you, Penelope, for saying that. And, you know, one of the things is that, and I'm going to speak more to this in a few minutes, but when, you know, we're experiencing this chronic stress and abuse and trauma, and when it continues to be unsafe, as we, you know, even test little areas here and there, like I tested going ahead and getting up and leaving, knowing inside that there would be a consequence, is that, but my point is that there's no, we lose our voices early on. And again, like I said, I'm going to speak to this again in a minute, but that even if we do have the courage to say something or to speak up, that there is such a heavy price to pay for that, that we just, you know, we learn really quickly, and at least I did very early on, not to speak. You know, that when I talk about betrayal and the loss of self, one of the huge losses is the loss of voice. Of course, loss of being seen, but loss of being heard, because we can't speak.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So true. Absolutely. I'm going to invite Kim, my co-host, just into the conversation as we, it's our first round with the panel, and we'll probably hopefully have one more. But Kim, did you have a question or a comment for Holly?
Thank you, Penelope. Yeah. You are so sweet too, Penelope. I just have to say that first. I mean, you just have like a great heart with the guests, and I love being on with you. And Holly, I am so sorry as well that you had to go through all of that. I was kind of almost tracking along with you a little bit throughout, you know, and just going, oh, there's a lot of similarities up until, because I used to spend summers with my grandparents, my brother and I, and we used to go to the races. So that, and then up until that point, you know, I was like, a lot is the same. I remember things changing when I was 5 or 6. And mine was because I got a stepfather, though. Mm. It wasn't of a younger sibling, but yeah, and so I'm just so sorry. I do, I feel for you as well, and just for that little girl. And I know that you're healed, but are working on it. It's an all ongoing process, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I guess
thank
I don't
you.
Really have a question right now, but excited to hear more about your story and more about you.
Thank you so much. I love being on your show, on this show, because people are so kind and compassionate and just so just thoughtful and compassionate. So thank you so much for that.
Mm-hmm. Well,
thank you.
We've been there. Yeah, we've been there, huh?
Yes.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to see if it was okay, Holly. I just have one more panel member to bring on.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And this is actually Lori, NASCA family member from New York. And Lori, I've unmuted your line, and you're on with Holly.
Hi. How you doing?
Hi. Good.
I'm listening, and I'm kind of, like, understanding where you're coming from. I came from an abusive family, and just a short version, my mother beat the crap out of me after my brother threw me out a second-story window. So I live with violence, like, all the time, every day, because that's how she was. So I know what you were feeling in there, basically, and it was devastating and scary. So I really, really do feel bad that that happened to you. The other question I have, you had briefly mentioned that you had this, you know, a younger sister. Are you still in contact with your sister today?
I have 3 sisters total, 1 older and 2 younger, and it is the youngest sister that my mom became what I call highly enmeshed with, and, just this unhealthy relationship, that's a whole nother piece, but it is part of the neglect that my other 2 sisters and myself felt. And to answer your question, the answer is no. And my mother passed away in 2019, but prior to that, my mother had disowned and disinherited my older sister and me and my younger sister. And so that had happened, as I said, in 2015. So there hasn't been any contact or any relationship with her for some time. And then, especially when my mom passed away in 2019. But there was no contact after 2015, and really sporadic contact before that because of all of her, sadly, her psychological issues and physiological issues and my mother's enmeshment with her.
Wow, that is unbelievable. Now, your older 2 sisters you're in contact with now?
My older sister and my 1 younger. That's right.
Younger.
Right, yeah, because I have 3, yeah.
I got memory problems.
That's okay. No, it's... yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's all I wanted to ask.
Uh-huh.
Well, thank you, Lori. That's great questions, and I'm going to put you back in the listen-only mode, and we'll hopefully have another opportunity to been on the panel and asked more questions to Holly, but we appreciate you calling in. And I'm going to put you in listen-only mode now. And Holly, thank you. And I'm just going to turn it back to you. I'm really kind of chomping at the bit to hear more.
Okay, well, here we go. And I just wanted to thank the last caller also for her questions. Appreciate that. So when I left off, I was about around age 8 when that incident happened at the horse racing track. Then at age 11, so meanwhile, getting back to my home, and it continues to be chaotic and critical and difficult, but we're just motoring along, as I said, was one of my older sister and I being the parentified children. And at age 11 is that there was a neighbors who lived across the street, and they had a teen female daughter who was a little bit older than me, but a lot larger than I was in height and stature and all of that. And I was somewhat friends with her, but not very much. But one day my mom said, you should go across the street and see what, so-and-so is doing. We didn't spend a lot of time over at that house, but I went over there, and this larger female teen neighbor was there by herself. Her parents weren't home, and a game of tag turned into a physical and sexual assault. She grabbed me, threw me to the ground. I fought with her. She started molesting me, and I was able to, even though she was on top of me and she was so heavy and just felt so big, because I was pretty petite for my age, I was able to slither kind of underneath her and escape, and I ran home. And I can see it as clear as day, is that my mom was at the kitchen sink washing dishes, and I ran in. My clothes are torn, and I'm, a mess. And I ran in, and I told her I was crying and what happened. And with her hands still in the kitchen sink, she turned to me, and she said, "Holly, we don't talk about that kind of thing. I never want to hear you speak about any of this ever again. Go to your room and change your clothes. Get cleaned up." And so I did. And again, I want to share that importance of that shutting down of our voices, because when I'm speaking and when I'm working with survivors and when I'm doing workshops for clinicians and things, I really encourage them to tap into that loss of self and loss of voice, because what I learned right then and there, as many victims do, is I will not speak of this. I will keep my mouth shut. It's my fault anyway. This is, no one's going to protect me. No one's going to help me, and this is my fault, and just keep my mouth shut. Now, for me, this was really important, because about 2 years later, I cannot remember exactly if I was 12 or 13 when this happened, but my parents decided that I was going to go spend, it was at least a month, in another state. Actually, it was Nevada. And this distant cousin and her family, their son, when I went to stay with them for a month, their son was going to come and stay with my family because he needed to complete some credits at the junior college or something like that. I don't know. But what happened was, and I don't give details on this, partly because, and importantly, because it's so re-traumatizing for me. I've dealt with it in therapy. I was only able to access all of the trauma and all the memories through hypnotherapy years later. But when I've shared this story before, like I said, it was just this was out on a ranch in the middle of nowhere, and it was just the house of horrors. I will just put it that way. There was a mother and a father, a male and a female adults, and then a female cousin. And it's not even a cousin. It was called our cousin, but there was no blood relationship. And then this male who I had switched places with also returned, and I was still there. And there was exploitation, there was sexual exploitation, exposure, incest going on in the home. It like I said, it was just sick, toxic, a house of horrors. And I was there for at least a month or maybe longer. So, of course, when I returned home, I had learned the lesson very well that I'm not going to tell anybody because no one's going to believe me. No one wants to hear it. And I would be blamed and shamed. And so I just buried and repressed that whole horrific 5-6 weeks, whatever it was, and never shared it with anyone until a beautiful, wonderful therapist many, many years later. And so I'll just go on to say that the household, I wanted to back up for just a second. At age 11, when I was assaulted by the teen across the street, when I was in my room getting cleaned up and changing my clothes, is that I made a promise to myself at that point. And that was, even though I had no clue or understanding of anything around, you know, abuse, trauma, alcoholism, anything like that. There was no internet, anything like that. Is that I was going to do whatever it would take to get out of that house. So I just wanted to back up and say that I was already a good student, but I made a decision at that point that I was going to just dive into my studies, into music, because that was also a passion, because that was going to be my ticket out. So after this other horrific assault, abuse at age around 13, and when I got back, I just reaffirmed that commitment to myself, that promise that whatever I had to do for the grades, all of that, so I could graduate and go to college. So that was what my plan was, to get out of that. So the household didn't change. It was still unmanageable, chaotic, anger, outbursts. And I want to mention that sarcasm again, because my nickname was Horrible Holly. We all had one, but that was mine. And another thing that my parents told us is that they practiced contraception and that we were all mistakes, believed that I wasn't loved. But then to have that joked about and teased about solidified in my mind that I wasn't wanted. I wasn't planned. They made that clear that we were mistakes, and therefore I wasn't wanted. So anyway, to wrap this part up is that I did complete that. I mean, I did what I needed to do academically and musically so I could get away.
I know I've heard your story or parts of your story before, Holly, but it's hard to even formulate words to even articulate and address how all of that laid upon me. There are just so many layers and years of abuse and neglect. You know, even being in the environment of the relatives for 6 weeks in that type of environment, I mean, 6 weeks is like, it must have felt like 600 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't imagine what that was like day after day. I think, you know, and you'd mentioned too, chasm.
the nickname of Horrible Holly. In terms of healing, you know, to me, one of the hardest things is to be when you're born into an abusive home, and you live in this environment, is the journey to self-love and how do you learn how to love yourself, and just the label of that it's so profound, and it's just I mean, I appreciate you sharing that, but it's just unbelievable. That parents just can't, you know, do we as survivors, just because we have the experience, know not to do that from our own experience, and we don't want to replicate the past pain? Or did we have parents that just were willfully neglectful? It's just a question that I always struggle with, and I don't know if you've asked yourself that question either, but
I was doing the research for my daughter, the Daughters Betrayed by Their Mothers book, I'm going to connect this to betrayal. I'd had three, pretty solid connotations, explanations of betrayal. And just for the listening audience, is that, I have this little saying that when we peel away the layers of injury and injustice and trauma and abuse, it almost always boils down to some type of betrayal. So I know, in the clinical world, we use the terminology betrayal trauma. I'll put that out there. And there's just so many different kinds of betrayal, so many different kinds of losses, bring it back to what you were saying, is that when I was interviewing the daughters for that book, Daughters Betrayed by Their Mothers, another definition emerged from that research, which kind of speaks to what you were saying, and because I had thought about it before, and first of all, we can't make sense out of something that doesn't make sense, and betrayal doesn't make sense. But, and at the same time, what I learned from the daughters is that parents fall in, caregivers, guardians, whoever is in charge of us, are either unable, incapable, or unable to parent in the ways that we consider healthy parenting and nurturing parenting, and that is not excusing any of it for any reason. I was trying to, in that research, put some quote unquote, if you will, labels on what this kind of neglect and abuse and trauma is about. So from all of the different mothers and fathers and different guardians of those females that I interviewed, I say unable because sometimes there weren't the resources or the support. Maybe it was a single parent, and she in this case, the mother, didn't have the support. Again, none of this excuses it. It just helps to explain. There's crossover in these. Some of the mothers and fathers too were unwilling. I mean, they were self-absorbed. Maybe they were narcissistic or borderline personality disorders or self-absorbed or into their addictions and alcoholism and those kinds of things. But their needs were paramount over their children's needs. And certainly in my case, where there was the alcoholism, where my parents were both, well, especially my father, very, very selfish. He never wanted to get married. My mother got pregnant. They had to get married. And so, we were punished, in essence, as I look back for that. But, okay, so the second category is unwilling. And that I see as more of a choice. And then the last one is incapable. Again, not excusing it, is, and I, in that category, and again, there's overlap, it's more around that there are clinical disorders. I know my mother suffered from depression and anxiety. Again, not an excuse, but there's clinical disorders, there's psychiatric disorders, there's personality disorders. Maybe their whole family of origin has a lack of parenting. I know I found out, you know, later my mother had she was like one of 8 or 9 children. It was a very strict home, lots of beatings and those kinds of things. So again, unable, unwilling, incapable. So, you know, the flip side is, as you were saying, Penelope, you know, when I made my promise to myself at age 11 that I was going to get out of the house, the other promise I made myself was that if I ever had the privilege of being a mother, that I would do it differently. I you know, again, with so little understanding, and I kept that promise. And it took a lot of therapy and a lot of hard work. So anyway, kind of a long answer to an important question.
Well, I appreciate your answer. And as you're, you know, explaining your answer, of course, you know, as we're all here and we've had similar experiences, I'm actually referencing some of it to my own experience with my own parents. So I do appreciate the explanation because it's helpful. It's helpful.
Okay.
And I think sometimes when it's helpful and just, and, you know, the understanding helps with the healing. And the more I understand, the more I can put the pieces together, the more I can make some sense. So why? It's, like you said, doesn't mean it's okay. It's just an explanation. It helps me to develop compassion and to forgive and to, you know, heal. So it's beneficial for all of us. So I appreciate that. I wanted to know, did you want to continue on or should I break the panel again? It's really up to you, Holly. We have about 30 minutes left. So it's fine.
Okay. Well, if it may be one or two questions, if there's any there.
Okay. Kim, did you have any questions for Holly?
No, I'm just, you know, like I said, I'm just sorry that you had to go through all of that. And I'm fascinated, you know, with that whole moms, you know, not being there for their kids. And, you know, mine, like I said, is a little bit different, but it kind of changed at the same time in my life. And then there were it was later on in my life, my stepdad sexually abused me. And when I told my mom that it had happened, she basically told me, yeah, that happened. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, all girls are sexually abused by their dad. Oh. And that's a normal thing. And I'm just like, and my mom passed away almost 20 years ago. And I don't know. I think it would be real interesting for her to be alive right now with the kind of work and stuff that I'm doing as well. I'm not sure how we would get along. But my stepdad, and he's still around, and he's still very selfish. And, you know, it's all about him, and it doesn't matter what I'm going through. I also lost my only brother 6 years ago. And and so I'm like, you know, I've forgiven him, but I'm also struggling, and I still struggle sometimes with that. And, you know, that my mom just enabled him for so long, and it just wasn't, it just wasn't right. And so I guess to some degree, I blamed her as well, because I told her, and she could have made a different choice.
Yes.
And,
yes.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I know, you too. I mean, it is. That's why I'm so fascinated with your book too. I mean, it makes perfect sense. I got that.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And you know, Penelope, Lori, I hear, you know, this story is, I hear so frequently, just so tragically, and that, you know, the mother isn't believing or other siblings aren't believing or the siblings are the perpetrators. And it's, you know, I often say where there's one betrayal, there's multiple betrayals. And it just, you know, that lack of trust, the lack of being able to trust anyone, to believe, have anybody believe you, and just that, again, lack of that loss of voice and loss of a healthy attachment to anyone, not having that protection, that safety, that security, and the losses just go on, and we internalize them all, and it takes years later to unravel all of those. So I want you to know I hear that, and I understand that. I can connect with that, and I'm so sorry.
No, thank you so much. You're so sweet. Yeah, it is. It's something that, like I said, I think you have to realize, too, as an adult. I didn't even start talking about it until I was 50, almost. Mm-hmm. And which, you know, is normal, I think, for a lot of us. We just wanted everything to be good. I wanted to be perfect, too. And I,
yeah,
you know, that's sweet little Kim. But, yeah, so, you know, I definitely connect with you as well. So thank you for all the research and stuff that you're doing around that. Because that's something that I haven't really dived into, you know, done a lot of self-help work, things like that. But I really haven't dove into forgiving my mom. I mean, what that looks
mm-hmm.
like. And, you know, I say, yeah, I forgave her. Because it's easy to say that when they're gone, you know, yeah, okay. but I made a decision, you know, a few years ago that I was going to take a more active role in making sure that children are safe. And I knew, I think just like you did, that we didn't know how exactly to parent, but we knew how to not to do it. And so,
yes,
you know,
yes,
that's where we came from, and just, you know, did the best that we could, and that was better. It was better than what we had as children.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you should be very proud of yourself as well, and just that you have come so far.
Yes. You know, if I could, Penelope, because the word forgiveness, is it Kim that is on the line now? Okay. I'd like to just talk about forgiveness for a minute, especially in the context of betrayal. And in my research and my work and in my books on the Breaking Through Betrayal books, there's two of those, first edition and second edition. But my point being is that I put forgiveness as the second to the last chapter. And, you know, this is my professional belief. This is my personal experience. And when I'm talking about psychological concepts and healing concepts, you know, the same thing doesn't work for, there are no absolutes. What works for one person may not work for another, but I just kind of take it generally from, like I said, from my work and from my research and what I've learned, especially around betrayal. And some of the pitfalls, and it's really not any fault of the victim at all or the person who has been betrayed, is that many times we forgive prematurely and, you know, maybe we're not ready or it's too soon, but we're mandated either, you know, by someone or something that, you know, maybe it's a faith-based belief or someone in our family just tells us we have to forgive, or, you know, it's some source,
yeah,
tells us that we need to forgive. There's this kind of belief set out there that is that, you know, we're supposed to forgive, that's what we're supposed to do, and we should do that in order to begin our healing. Well, the problem is with betrayal, as I said a minute ago, not only if you have one, do you usually have many, but sometimes betrayal is ongoing. whether the person, whether the betrayer is alive or dead or in the picture or not, but the betrayals continue on, and there's lots of reasons for that. So when a person forgives prematurely, or when they're not ready or they've been told to, then in my work and in my opinion, we really betray ourselves, because we're not healed. We're not in a place that we're really ready to release that person, to let that person go, which brings me to another important point, is that forgiveness is a very individual kind of practice, and people have lots of different connotations around it, what they think of it, what it means. And so when I'm working with clients, I make sure that if they say that's important to them, that we really flush out and explore what their understanding of forgiveness is. Because I, of course, don't want to see them betray themselves by forgiving the betrayer if they're not healed, they're not ready, or if they cannot really buy into the betrayal, the forgiveness that that has been given to them. For example, I was working with a client once, and her faith was really, really important to her, and I can connect with that. I have a lot of faith-based clients, and she said, well, I was told that I have to forgive because I have to pick up the tab for the betrayer, which happened to be her father, who was, had been raping her most of her life. So for her to pick up the tab, and I asked her how that felt, and, she just started crying and sobbing, and she felt shame and guilt and just horrific self, just devaluing of herself and degrading of herself. So I'm kind of talking about a lot of important things here, but first and foremost is I believe that it's really important to feel safe and secure and at peace with whatever your interpretation of forgiveness is, that settles well with you. And secondly, that forgiveness should happen when you are in a healed enough place to offer that for yourself, not for the other person. And again, keeping in mind your degree of exposure to the betrayer or the betrayal environment or your relationship with the betrayer, because if the betrayals are chronic and ongoing and a person keeps forgiving, but then they continue to get re-betrayed, then that it's just this vicious cycle. So to wrap that piece up, forgiveness is complicated, it's complex, and I'm just do a lot of work with victims in this area, and can really. I read a beautiful definition from out of a book by Dr. Beth Hedvut. It's called Betrayal, Trust, and Forgiveness, and I love this definition. She says forgiveness is about for giving back to yourself. And I've put that in several of my books. So if we take that time to give back to ourselves and do our healing work, we'll know. I've seen it in clients. It's happened in myself, hundreds of clients. They know when they are ready to and healed enough to go ahead and release that person, the betrayer.
Yeah. I'm nodding my head if you can't see that through the phone.
I love that.
It's something, it's really a trap. I call it one of the traps of betrayal because for all the reasons I've said, but I think, unfortunately, in my opinion, Penelope and Kim, or anybody who's listening, is that because it's that societal or familial or social expectation or even spiritual mandate that's put down on us, that we get caught up in that and we really can get trapped by it instead of freed from it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. And thank you, Holly, because that's, I always call betrayal a hot topic, right, when we're doing the shows, because of everything that you said. I mean, it's just, it's so multifaceted, and it plays, you know, a role in the healing process, and it's an opinion piece. I've, you know, at least for those that have observed my healing and my journey, I call it an opinion piece from the customer satisfaction survey going on, you know, in my world, of others looking in at the work I'm doing. So I appreciate you bringing it up because, and within that context and that explanation, and that really resonated with me. And I love the forgiveness definition, you know, forgiveness back to myself. Forgiving yes. back to myself, forgiving back. That's a huge take-home message for me tonight. So thank you. I actually, if you're okay, I did want to bring Lori back on because I skipped her as we went down the panel last time. If you're okay with that, Holly, just to give her one more opportunity to ask a question, and then I'll turn it back over to you because we're in the last third of the show. So, Lori, I did unmute your line. I wanted to invite you to ask Holly a question about anything she shared with us so far tonight.
Moreover, it's just my opinion of hearing your beginning of your life, your foundation years, and where you are now. And I'm listening to all these wonderful things that you've managed to do with your history of abuse, and you just kind of like knock my socks off. I think you're awesome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. A lot of hard work, right?
Yeah, for you.
yes. It's when, well, I could get back to my, just to reference my journey a bit, is that once I began to embrace a healing journey, which there was, you know, there was still other trauma in my life at, in college and just a horrific first marriage and other things. But I, just to speak to this for a minute, is that once I finally had some healing under my belt, some recovery under my belt, and it was really the kind of what I call the first round of it in my early 30s, is that something that stuck with me was that my wellness had to, for me, it had to be the number one priority in my life. Probably because of, well, I believe that in general, but with the layers of trauma, the years of it, that I made that commitment to myself that my mental health, that my wellness was the most important thing in my life. And to this day, so 40 years later, there's nothing and no one that is more important than my wellness. And with that, that sets the stage for really, really tough boundary work, very selective investment into people, things, friends, family, professional colleagues. So it's, and I don't mean to sound like I'm this rigid person. It's just that I, under that umbrella of wellness, that all these years, and believe me, there have been periods that have been very difficult and very hard, and I step back and have to shore up things and revisit things. And so it's not this, you know, it's not this ski slope. It's this staircase up and down, up and down. But every time I have reminded myself of what is the most important thing, which is my wellness, then everything shuffles back into place. And, you know, whether I have to go back in and see a therapist again, with, like I said, whatever I have to shore up, clean up, clear up, process, get through. But that's the guiding principle of my life.
That's the journey, right? I mean, that is your
yes.
journey mm-hmm. that keeps you on the journey.
Mm-hmm.
How often do you have to remind yourself that that's the guiding principle of your life?
You know, it's been it's been less and less as I've gotten older, but it's, you know, Penelope, it's always there. You know, it's that internal compass that is
mm-hmm.
Such it is who I am. And, but, you know, I don't want to make it sound like it's ever easy, because it's not. It's in 2015, this is in my daughter's book, and just to give this as a point, so that's 7 years ago,
mm-hmm.
my family imploded with my parents both planning out and committing but not completing a dual suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And the trauma that caused in our family, and with very few family members having, I mean, that's hard enough to navigate when
mm-hmm.
you have a lot of healing under your belt and, you know, the knowledge that I have in my work and all of that. And with the majority of other family members not having as much of that, you know, internal experience and support, that our family just basically imploded. And so when that happened, is that in all the multitude, the tsunami of betrayals that came after that throughout our family, is that I, again, for a year, I pulled in and just really tended to the different aspects of my self-care and healing and all of that. So it's we never know, right? And so we know, here's the point to this that I want to say, I know more quickly, and I have
mm-hmm.
the tools more refined now than I did before. But I never believe that I'm home free.
Right, exactly. This is a quote that I always repeat to myself, which I read. It was written by Dr. Gabor Mate, and I'm sure you know his work. You know, staying conscious is daily work,
mm-hmm.
and I never take it for granted. And the reason I asked you that, you know, the question was, you know, in context, is that, you know, life happens, and even though, you know, I've done a lot of work, a lot of us have done a lot of work, life happens, and you find yourself having to navigate those things and still tend to self-care,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so to stay, you know, I think it's hopeful for me to know that, you know, you stay the course, you have to remind yourself less often, you know, but you
yes.
still have to remind yourself, but it becomes more second nature. So that's hopeful, you know, hopeful. Thank you for answering that question.
Absolutely. Thank you, Penelope. And yes, it just around that way of being. And I want to emphasize, and I already said it, but just to say it one more time, how important boundary work is. Because, again, there are a lot of societal and familial and cultural norms out there that dictate that we have to be in relationship with family. We have to be in relationship with so and so, and you know that there's a lot of pressure, and then individuals feel a lot of guilt when I have several clients right now that have such horrific, abusive family of origins, and especially in the cultural pieces, it's very diverse clientele that they. It is beyond a sin, I don't even have the right word for you to speak up to your mother or to your father. But point being is that establishing those boundaries, I know how hard that work is. And I believe that until we do that, or let me put it in a positive way, when we do that and we, you know, learn how to do that, learn what's, you know, how to implement them, how to massage them, how to shore them up, how to navigate within these boundaries, that when we start to experience that freedom of this way of being for ourselves and being just free to be ourselves without, you know, all that other noise and hurt and pain out there, we want that. You know, we want more of that. So then the boundary work becomes a little easier, still tough at times, but we're willing to do that because we know what we want and need for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of the hardest areas to work on, was for myself, and I see it with my clients as well.
Well, that absolutely resonates with me. Absolutely. I can completely align with that and all the emotions that go around it. And I think, you know, we're tribal by nature, and to pull away from a toxic tribe is really, really tough. It is hard, especially
yes.
when you're, for me, I found when you're biologically bound to them. You described it very well, something that I have always found very almost impossible to describe.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's what I so appreciate, Holly, about your work, is that I just feel like taking on the subject of betrayal is so brave. It is so brave. It is because it's just such a brutal, it's a brutal offense. It's almost a betrayal of a parent, a betrayal of someone that is bound to care for you and to protect you. It is such darkness and pain. And I just really admire your work so much because you've taken on betrayal. And just for me, and I know you've reached so many people, you were able to really articulate in your work, in your books, what I had experienced, the patterns that I had been living in, and bring a terminology to it, and you brought my awareness to a certain context where I could then step out and really understand and take a look at the pattern almost in third person, and really enhanced and expedited my work in therapy to be able to understand it and, like I said, really be able to define and articulate within that context of betrayal and really acknowledge those patterns. And so your work is just absolutely incredible, and I can't tell you how appreciative I am of the work that you've done and the books that you keep writing and the books that I'm going to keep on reading and just taking on those topics. Because it's a pretty lonely place to be when you've been betrayed by a parent. So I just wanted to tell you that and really to bring up that topic too, because I know we have just about 15 minutes left. So I didn't know if you had covered what you wanted to cover in terms of your latest book and betrayal.
Penelope, I just think I'm with you. I think this is topic, parental betrayal, it's, you know, whoever the guardian is or the caregiver is, it doesn't, you know, we can say parent, but whoever that caregiving person is, I just want to affirm you and validate you in that. And also thank you so much that if my words, if my books have been helpful, that That just means the world to me. It's why I do what I do. And again, to get back to this topic and around not just mothers betraying, but fathers and like I said, whoever it mm-hmm. Is that, and like I said, I'm thinking of the clients right now that I have it. There is just so much shame in even talking about it. You know, I mean, just guilt and shame and just it is so painful. And yet their pain is so deep and helping them to get through that. One of the things that I've been able to do with clients is, and I got a little bit of help from this from Brené Brown, is that Brené Brown says that the guilt is doing something that is, you've done something wrong, you've done something bad. Shame is that you are bad. And so when a client comes to me and they're talking about their parents, it doesn't matter who it is, but how they abused them, mistreated them, whatever, and they turn to me and they say, Holly, I feel so guilty. And so then I say, okay, you know, here's our definition of guilt. You know, is this wrong? Have you done something bad to be talking about your parents? And most of the time they say, yeah. You know, this is bad. I shouldn't be talking this way about them. And so, but that gives us sort of a foundation to move through that. You know, okay, so you feel badly, you know, you feel guilty. And then when we kind of move that they haven't done anything wrong, and in fact, it's the shame of what they're feeling from being abused or mistreated or, you know, whatever it was, that guilt is really mixed in with that shame that you feel that you are bad, that you are wrong. And, you know, this is complicated, but just to kind of help them unhook that a little bit and that you didn't do anything wrong and doing all of that work. So if you didn't do anything wrong, then why is talking about them bad? And again, this takes a lot of time and, you know, a lot of gentle work and unconditional positive regard and just really working with those words and the feelings that come up around them. It's tricky and it's important.
Well, it is, but I really felt that, you know, when I read the work that you did, and specifically because the one betrayal that I had the hardest time working on was the betrayal, you know, I was a daughter betrayed by her mother. It just mm-hmm. gave me permission. I mean, in all the case studies, I think exactly to what you said, it gave me permission to acknowledge it and to admit it. Mm-hmm. It was just the act of feeling that I had been given permission by what I had read by other people disclosing and being very honest and real and raw about their own experiences to almost say what was unspeakable, what had been unspeakable or unallowable. It gave me that permission. And that was huge. Oh. That just opened the door.
So glad.
Yeah, and I had been tasked when I first started my recovery therapy to write a letter to each parent of what I would keep with me from my childhood, the good, and what to get mm-hmm. back the bad. And it had taken me, I had started a letter to my mother about 5.5 years before I read your book, and I think I went in one paragraph and stopped, and I went on to writing a letter to my father. I was able to get that one out in about a year. And it was after I read your book. I got to the last page of your book. I read the very last paragraph, the last word. I got out of my car. I wouldn't even allow myself to go in the house because I knew I'd be able to get distracted. I found a scratch paper, and I wrote that letter, and I was able to get it off. So that is the power of the work that you're doing. At least it was for me.
Oh.
That was 5.5 years.
Oh, Penelope, I just... That moves me beyond belief. Thank you for sharing that. There's an acronym that I use for shame, and the first one's going to be yucky, and the second one's going to be exactly what you just said. So shame is self-hatred and malignant embarrassment. You know, that's when we're stuck in all that yuck. And then to do what you've done and to connect with those stories. So the second acronym is shared healing and mindful existence or meaningful existence, that through the daughters sharing their stories that you connected, and then you were able to take charge of your existence and make it meaningful for you. That just warms my heart.
Well,
it actually brings me to tears, so I'm trying to hold it together on this end.
Well, you know, I don't know how there could, you know, you can put into words how, you know, the gratitude that I feel for the work that you've done, because I'm 50. I just turned 53 this week, and for 50 years of my life, I carried all those burdens, that enmeshment. Mm-hmm. My mom, I was, used the term earlier, I was actually forced into that. Also that role of being the parentified child. And mm-hmm. I was parenting my mother for 50 years. And when I finally realized Love of Betrayals through reading your book and I wrote that letter, the punishment and the vindictiveness that resulted from me giving that back to her, to naming it and to breaking that pattern. That was all part of the betrayal, and that is what your work allowed me to do. And it had been 50 years of carrying that.
Wow.
And I was sent that letter off to my mother, and I was shaking like you wouldn't believe. I emailed it to her. I was shaking. I was literally shaking. I think I was shaking for about 2 hours afterwards too.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, I had never felt so light. I had never felt so free. And that really truly was from, and of course I was, been seeing a therapist, my psychologist, mm-hmm. and seeing it, and that was a lot of, I think you laid a lot of groundwork, but it was really that, the book and the work, and specifically with the betrayal of the mother mm-hmm. to the daughter that had really, to be able to identify with that and to be given permission and to, like I said, within mm-hmm. the context and to recognize the patterns. I think there are a lot of different touch points, I think, that we have to go through to really pull it all together. But I would say mm-hmm. that book was like, you know, the roller coaster that I needed to be on, right?
Yes.
To catapult me into that next step. So this is not meant to be about me, but really meant to be more about your work and betrayal, but it is just powerful and impactful work.
Penelope, thank you so very much. Like I've said before, it's why I do what I do, and that book, which was the most difficult book to research and to write, was also for me one of the most healing books that I've written. And of course, I wrote my stories. The first one, interviewing the other daughters, was just incredible, and it has helped. It's helped so many daughters and sons. The messages that I've gotten, and to speak to what you're talking about, and if that's what my work does, then I'm a happy girl, and it's why I do what I do, because it's it just touches me beyond belief, and it's so important to be speaking and talking about these things that do not get talked about. And that's why I gave the TED Talk, because, again, it's saying, and that has a little bit different of a bent. It's still about the loss of self, because I believe that when we are betrayed, we lose ourselves and all these different pieces of ourselves. So thank you so much for, I'd like to just use you as my poster child, my poster daughter. So thank you for that feedback.
Oh, you're so welcome. Well, I'm so appreciative for the work that you do and all the books. And I know you're probably, I know you just released your 11th book. Are there more books coming in the future? I mean, 11 books, that's a lot of books. That's a lot of work.
Yes, there will, I think I hadn't planned it that there was, my next book was going to be on betrayal, another one, but I have four on betrayal, but there's sort of around what we're talking tonight, but some more just research as I've and experienced the past 4 or 5 years that I've been back in practice, in my private practice. I think I may need to do another book on betrayal, but if it's not that, there's another one. You know, I'll be working on it next year. Just busy with other things right now. But, yeah, there will be another one.
Oh, well, something more to look forward to.
In the most recent book, the Shifting Bravely, I mean, those stories, those are also stories from people that you can see the betrayals in them, and it's also very helpful. Doesn't call out betrayal specifically, but it's there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, betrayal, the loss no one is talking about. Mm. I'm wondering, you know, it'd be interesting to see a book on betrayal. Well, I feel that the school systems in certain states during COVID really betrayed children from a lot of their civil liberties and a lot of their childhood. But it was a real betrayal, and I think in their ability to develop and to help the individual, especially state by state. And there are a lot of states that made the decisions to keep their kids home and not allow them to go back to school. So I don't know. Maybe because I'm a mom, my kids were there, but when I think of betrayal, too, I think about what happened to our children during COVID. So, unfortunately, it's a gift that keeps on giving, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I agree with you, and there's so many layers. And somebody mentioned to me today, Holly, have you ever written about, you know, when your body betrays you? And, I mean, that's something I've talked about with people, spoken about. But so, yeah, it can be, it's cultural, it's political, it's physical, it's, yeah, their betrayal is that unfortunate, yeah, just hate to say gift because it's not that, but it's just that, it's there, so, yeah.
Well, I hate that this 90 minutes has gone by so quickly, but unfortunately it has. We've got about a minute left, and so I didn't know if there was just a couple sentences, a couple words that you wanted to leave our listeners with before I signed off on the show.
Well, I would just like to encourage listeners to tell your stories when you're ready. Remember, I talked about voice a lot during the show, and here's what I want to say, Penelope, is that betrayal robs us from everything and anything that is a part of who we are. And the insidious piece about betrayal is that it is our human nature to want to turn outward, to try to recoup those losses, to try to self-soothe those losses, to self-medicate, whatever all those words are. And in order to heal from betrayal, we must turn inward. And again, that runs contrary to what our mind and messages are telling us, to turn inward, that everything that was taken or stolen or robbed from us, we can give that back to ourselves. We must give that back to ourselves, and we can. And I show you how in the books that I've written. And in my TED Talk, I close with this comment. is that time will not heal the trail, but what you choose to do with your time makes healing possible. So, and having the tools to do that. So,
thank you. That is amazing. This has been a special guest night with the exceptional Holly Kenley, a child abuse survivor, therapist, author, activist. I just thank you so much, Holly, for coming on the show tonight. I always so enjoy talking with you, and I learned so much from our conversations. And I want to also thank Kim Lakin, my co-host tonight, and for all of you listening. The show will be archived in about 30 minutes onto the NASCA website at naasca.org. Holly, again, my most humble thank you and gratitude for having the opportunity to speak with you again this evening. And with that, I wish you all good evening.
Good evening, and thank you.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that's gone with love. You are forgotten after all that you've done.
Blog Talk Radio.